I left Damascus when I was very young, and I really remember, what I remember the most is my family was there. And my cousins who I would play with, my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents. And when I left Syria and Damascus, I found myself constantly trying to my hardest to hold on to any memory I had of my family. And so maybe I remember that time with rose-colored glasses, but I used to always think that those were the best years of my life, you know, the first few years, actually.
Can you tell me?
I moved to Australia when I was 7.
And what years were those 7 years?
What years were they?
Yeah.
They were in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s.
And what do you remember from Syria back then? As a 7-year-old?
You know, it was very peaceful. It was, you know, we could go to the playground, like the Jahez, the people were happy. You know, and it's not like I haven't been back to Syria since then. I had been back several times. And there's something charming about it that I think is lost now. You know, that old, people might think of it as something that I shouldn't say, but the old Soviet kind of bloc countries, they were quaint. They had their own, like, simple charm about them, not complicated with materialism. And I just, I remember the community the most.
Tell me about what led you to pursue studies in biophysics and chemistry at the University of Western Australia, right?
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know what? I was just very good at chemistry. And I just thought it would be easier because if I were to have studied political science, then the professor might have a disagreement with me politically, is what I expected. And I thought to myself, you know, they won't be able to fight me if I do science, because who can argue with science?
Right.
They can't argue with me on a political basis. And I do love chemistry, and I'm here for the Mustafa Prize, which is in science.
Of course, it's a pleasure to have you.
Yes, thank you. And so, unfortunately, I was wrong about that. Turns out they can definitely still fight you politically, even if you choose science.
Science is your field.
Yes, they can make sure that your career in science is hurt, in spite of it being, you know, it shouldn't involve politics. But that was the basis of my decision, because also the other thing is I feel like you can not learn science on your own. You really need a teacher. But politics, you can live it and you can breathe it and it can just be a part of you without having to study it formally. And I like the concept of a Renaissance soul, someone who isn't just one thing, they're everything.
Absolutely, and in a way, I think you made the right choice because you, by going through science, you kind of build up a sort of background and you come from the world within to know the world outside. So that's beautiful, you know, kind of the turn from science and from the world within into the outer world. That's very interesting, actually, and I'm sure it kind of shaped your perspective into politics and everything.
I think it brought a bit of the scientific method to analysis of politics as well. And sort of when you make a prediction about what's going to happen in the future, you can almost use science in a way. You can use axioms, you know, methods, formulas. Not so rigid, but in a way you can kind of say like an axiom of in real politic, which I no longer ascribe to, but in real politic, a nation will always do what is in its interest. Of course, I don't believe that to be true anymore. But that is...
Why is that? That is also very interesting. Why don't you believe in that?
Because I feel that sometimes a nation will not act in the interest of itself or its people, but in the interest of the economic of the individual or the, you know, sometimes people make mistakes as well.
Yeah.
So if a nation does something that is against its own interest, like the U.S., for example, when it basically commits suicide on the altar of Zionism, that doesn't really benefit the American people. So it's kind of it breaks that realpolitik axiom down. You have to invent new axioms to explain the world.
I see. All right. Were there moments during your university years that sparked your interest in geopolitics?
To be honest, it started in high school. I attended my first pro-Palestine rally at the age of 15.
Wow.
I think that the 9/11 was very radicalizing, because after that there was the war in Afghanistan, followed by the war in Iraq. And I was protesting the war in Afghanistan even as a teenager. And then I was looking for any activists that were protesting the Iraq war as well. So I think that I, by virtue of where I come from and understanding just some things about politics there, I already had a sense of justice that I wanted to follow. It wasn't until, you know, it was from teenagehood to university before I started my YouTube channel.
Right, and tell me something. You were 15, you just said.
Yes.
You know, what was your worldview back then, and how did you come up to the growth of realizing that you had to join in these solidarity movements?
You know, I'm thinking back now. I think I started watching the news when I was about 12, and I felt like I was being lied to. And I feel silly to say this now. At 12, I wrote a letter to the news asking them why they expected us to be so stupid.
Ah.
This was to the Australian news.
Do you remember the specific news story that you wrote about?
I don't. I just remember thinking that you're insulting our intelligence. And yeah, I wrote an email, I think, to them. And it was a tabloid show.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're going to insult your intelligence. I think it was Australians would know it as, you know, Channel 9, not the news, but after the news. It's like Current Affairs. It was Current Affairs. So I guess from there grew a skepticism about the media and what we're being told, and investigating it myself. And I was, I guess, exposed as well, because, you know, when you're Syrian, you're not alone in Australia. You also have your own community.
Yeah.
You have a Lebanese, especially diaspora, and you get exposed to other news, international news, and then you compare and you understand that there's lies. And I think that that feeling of there's people are lying, it just made me angry, and it drove me to act and go
so,
to protest.
So that feeling hit you at the very age of 15.
Yeah, 12 to 15.
Tell me something. How long did it take for you to decide to do something about it, to get out of the loop of mainstream media?
It was the war. It was the war in Afghanistan. That's what caused me to...
The so-called war on terror.
Yes, and then when the war in, I just thought it was unjust, and that all these children were being murdered, and America doing it in a way that I thought they had planned. I read that they had plans for the war before 9/11, and so I thought, okay, there's something else going on here. It's not just terrorism that they're filing. There's something else. And then when the war in Iraq started, I had this strong sense that Syria was going to be next.
How so?
Well, of course, there was General Wesley Clark that said there was 7 countries in 5 years.
Yeah,
but he
yeah.
said that in 2005, 2006. I had that sense in 2003. I guess I could explain it by saying, you know, there was the axis of evil. Although Syria, I don't think was one of them? It was
not.
Iran, North Korea, and Iraq.
Yeah.
So it wasn't Syria, but I thought, well, like, obviously, Syria is going to be next. And it made me upset or angry that not more is being done to to stop this war in Iraq.
And what were the first steps that you took in order to raise awareness?
Well, look, I was just a teenage girl, so there wasn't much that I could do.
But you had social media.
I had social media, but at the time I was completely anonymous online. I only became in the public eye when the war in Syria began. So during...
Back in 2011, right?
Yeah, exactly. So before that, I was very paranoid and anonymous on the internet. But in real life, I would go to protests. I would give leaves at university for students. And I would join activist groups. But all of that, when the internet came about and became another voice for the people and, an alternative to the mainstream media, which had dominated for so long, I realized that there was more power staying inside on the internet than even being outside on the street. That's not always the case. But for some people, if you do it in the right way, it can be just as powerful, if not more powerful, than being on the street.
Naomi just said that in the very beginning, you were mostly anonymous. I'm curious to know why.
Well, I got a few reasons. Firstly, naturally, privacy and anonymity is a strength in life. And, you're protecting your identity, your family, from targeting, from being politically targeted.
Yeah.
But at the time, especially at the start of 2003, the Iraq War, I was concerned about what Australia called sedition laws.
Uh-huh.
And there was sort of a chilling effect. They announced that if you support the Iraqi resistance or any kind of resistance against the U.S. Invasion, then you could be charged with sedition. And sedition means to go against your government.
Yeah. Oh.
So I was worried about that. I think in retrospect, it was a bluff. I didn't have the wisdom at the time as a teenager to understand that.
Well, if you ask me, you had a lot of wisdom. But anyways, tell me something. How did you transition from science into political commentary?
I think I just always had both at the same time. They kind of conflict. Sometimes they work together, especially when the topic of the news is science. For example, the chemical attacks in Syria, which, now if you were to listen to the Turkish news, which was last week, they'll say that the first chemical attack that happened was in Ghouta in 2013, and they will say that, this is like the anniversary of that. But they will completely forget that 6 months before that, there was an attack on a government-held area in Aleppo, for example. And my knowledge of chemistry did help in understanding what was happening, how they were lying, why they were lying, etc. But the two sides of me do compete. And unfortunately, the science side has suffered because of the political side. How did I transition? I did an interview one time with a guy called 108, Morris 108.
Nice.
YouTube has shut him down now, and unfortunately he's passed away. But it went viral, and I realized because it went viral, it was called Al-Qaeda is Al-CIA. And because it went viral, I decided I could do more.
So that was like the kind of a main motivation for you to publicly start and share your views?
It was the war in Syria. I thought, if this is my identity and my privacy is worth sacrificing to expose the truth about what's happening in Syria. Because
right.
That's my duty to my birth country.
Of course. I want you to expand a little bit about the vision that you had for launching the YouTube channel and adopting the name Syrian Girl.
Well, Syrian Girl was not the name I originally adopted. It was actually given to me by 108, Morris 108, this gentleman he made excellent videos. Unfortunately, YouTube deleted all his interviews, and then he passed away. But he gave me an anonymous name, because at the beginning I was still trying to maintain some level of anonymity by not revealing my full name.
Understand.
My original name that I wanted to give myself was Partisan Girl. And which means resistance girl. And, you know, that sort of, but I was talking about Syria, so it's easy. Syrian girl. And that is, so he actually advised me to start a channel. I wanted to talk about a topic, and he said, I'm not interested in this topic. You should create your own YouTube channel and talk about it.
Right. And how did your content evolve as the Syrian civil war intensified?
Well, you know, at the beginning it was about breaking.
Did you ever visit Syria during the civil war?
In fact, I visited the year that the last visit was in 2011.
Oh,
yeah.
I see that. So it was the country was already involved with the war, or it was beforehand?
It was the cusp. It was just the cusp of it. So I saw Syria at its most beautiful. And then not since then.
Could you see the turmoil coming?
You know, Libya. Obviously, I could see the writing on the wall from Libya. Yes,
I see.
But when I was there before that, because I would visit every year or every 2 years, I would visit. There was no indication, except for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera was a big indicator. Too many people were watching it. Too many satellite dishes were open to it, and that. I could see it had a very negative influence.
Oh.
Yes.
And so you think
on society.
It kind of had the effect of mainstream media on this specific topic?
I think that it, especially Al Jazeera in Arabic, had more of a sectarian vibe to it. So that's why and Al Arabiya as well. So those two channels on Syrian satellite television, I think that wasn't a good sign. Also, the president at the time, Bashar al-Assad, he did open up the country because they were demanding this of him in 2009. And he did so by allowing Facebooks and the internet and stuff. I also saw already that Facebook was a maligned influence. So I wasn't really particularly happy with the way that the country was going with the rapprochement to the West. Because I guess I live in the West. And so for Syrians, what they would see as something desirable that they want to be a part of, I actually saw it for its flaws. Yeah. And I saw in Syrian society the things that they themselves didn't value or didn't think was cool or interesting. For example, the principle of self-sufficiency, where, you know, we don't have iPhones, but we would produce our own electronics, or maybe we don't have the latest fashions, but we create our own fashions.
Right.
And they were more interested in KFCs, a new KFCs opening, whereas I liked the fact that Syria had a unique set of cuisine and restaurants that you can't get anywhere else in the world.
Of course.
So this is something, unfortunately, that I don't think will survive the new regime.
Of course. And what challenges have you faced in maintaining an independent voice online?
Well, I've had many death threats.
Death threats?
Yes, absolutely. From various sources. The Jolanists, for example, the ones that are supporting the current Al-Qaeda leader. And the ISIS, of course, the Israelis. Many death threats from the Israelis, attacks from the Zionist lobby, being named by the ADL, being named by Australian Zionist lobbies, attacked at my workplace or university. They would, for years, send harassing letters. Actually, one of the funniest things that happened in 2014 was there's a guy called Dan Kazeta, who worked for a guy called Elliot Higgins, and they were responsible for trying to manufacture consent for a war on Syria. And this Dan Kazeda guy is entitled to Israeli citizenship, just FYI. And he wrote a letter to my university claiming that I was working with sarin gas in the laboratory. But I was doing theoretical chemistry. My work was all on the computer. So, yeah, this I have the letter, and, you know, the repercussions from that wasn't so bad because obviously it was a joke what he did. But the guy he was working with, Elliot Higgins, the British Foreign Office also attacked me. They called me a Russian bot. You know, there was many media attacks that exposed my identity was doxxed, my address was doxxed, and the media would write harassing pieces about me constantly. And you just, you know, there's too many people to fight all the time. This is a problem. They tried to prevent me from submitting my PhD. So all of those things happen. But these are very small things compared to the suffering of people who are under the bombs or the soldiers that have to go to the front lines. So for me, it's a very simple sacrifice to make. So I always wondered if what I was doing had any positive effects. But I feel that recently more and more people have come to me and told me that I've changed their minds, or I started them on a journey when they were young, and they became who they were. Even people inside Australian Parliament have told me that, you know, watching my Twitter feed has changed their mind. Like, they were supportive of Israel for 20 years, but because of the seeing what's happening in Gaza on my feed, suddenly they've looked at everything completely differently. Lucas Gage, he wrote the song Boom Boom Tel Aviv. He will tell you that there was a time where his Twitter account was deleted, and you know, I brought it back. I helped him bring it back. So I feel like in small ways I planted some seeds and I'm watching them grow. And I hope in future, my future is that the front lines are not going very well, to be perfectly frank, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Gaza. And hopefully they will be better in Iran. But there is another front line, and it's in the West. And it's the hearts and minds of the West. And that's where my future focus is going to be.
I wanted the conversation to go on for hours, but unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to bring this to a close. But as a tradition of our show, towards the end of the program, our guests usually have 1 or 2 minutes to talk directly. Our audience will become yours, so feel free to share whatever you want with our audience.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. I didn't know that I was going to be talking mostly about myself, so I apologize for that. I guess the most important thing I can tell you is that Israel is the Jewish ISIS, and they will not stop unless they are stopped. I feel that for the benefit of Iran, whilst, you know, I respect the opinions of the administration, I feel that the way of North Korea is the way to go, and there's nothing wrong with Iran having the nuclear bomb. In fact, I think the atomic bomb maybe the only way to protect Iran's borders, because Israel does have the atomic bomb, and they need an answer to that. Otherwise, they're going to continue to attack furiously. So I wish Iran the best of luck. I hope that it remains the backbone of the resistance. I'm sorry that Syria can't participate, but hopefully in future everything will change and our alliance will return.
Maram Sisley, it was a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for staying with us on another SOAP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Nuraei.
east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For decades, the so-called two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine question has dominated Western diplomacy, enshrined in the controversial Oslo Accords of the early 1990s. 30 years on, many here say that solution was dead on arrival.
It's impossible now, in any event, even if it was desirable, which I don't think it ever was, to actually create a two-state proposition, because the West Bank, for example, has been completely atomized by the Zionist entity. So I think we need to rip that idea up and to start again. And what we're campaigning for is a one-state solution.
Critics of the two-state solution, now pushed for by Saudi Arabia and France at the United Nations, also pointed to Israel's ongoing genocidal assault on Gaza.
What they are actually doing is consolidating the gains made by the Zionist entity, which includes the absolute annihilation of Gaza, the continued terrorism that is being taken place by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what they actually want to do is consolidate the 80-odd years of Zionist settler colonialism.
The debate organized by activist independent movement grew heated, with some arguing for a state, including all Palestinians and those who live in what's now called Israel, if they wish to stay.
Every Palestinian should have the right to return. And Israelis who decide they want to stay will have obligation to assist the Palestinian to settle back to their home, and that means everywhere.
Opponents of that view argue it resembles South Africa after the end of apartheid, when many of the immigrant white population got to stay.
The concept of, you know, what is mine and what is yours is so simple, and actually people are trying to pretend there's shades of grey. No, actually it's very black and white. There's Palestine, and there's a fake terrorist construct called Israel that needs to be dismantled.
Dr. Ali also suggests that armed struggle by Palestinians is the only pathway to one state being materialized.
Armed struggle is legal under international law. And rather than, you know, and what we should be doing is arguing for deprescription of perfectly legitimate legal organizations under international law, we should be never condemning resistance.
At the end of the debate, it was obvious which motion received more support.
With the Israeli regime openly rejecting Palestinian statehood as it commits genocide in Gaza, the debate here mirrors a wider global reckoning. The two-state solution has repeatedly failed. The consensus here, a one-state solution with equal rights for all the indigenous inhabitants of historical Palestine. Saeed Pereza from Birmingham, United Kingdom.
This Friday, the quartet comprising the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt issued a joint statement declaring that Sudan's war has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis and threatens regional peace and security. The group called for a three-month humanitarian truce, unrestricted aid access and a clear transition process towards civilian-led governance within 9 months. By Saturday, Sudan's government delivered its response. While stressing it welcomes genuine efforts to ease the conflict, the government underlined that no initiative will succeed unless it respects Sudan's sovereignty and the legitimacy of its national institutions. The statement also rejected attempts to place the state on equal footing with the militia, emphasizing that Sudan alone has the right to shape its political path during the transitional period.
The Quartet's statement have no legal or international legitimacy. They were formed to impose guardianship on Sudan. The UAE fueled and funded this war. Everyone knows who arms the RSF. These resolutions are worthless, equating the army with the militia and each time the army advances, the quartet rushes to rescue the UAE's spoiled child.
Khartoum also noted that international actors have struggled to enforce previous UN Security Council resolutions, including those on the siege of Al-Fashir. While the quartet is pushing for a new roadmap, analysts point out that earlier efforts failed to deliver lasting results, leaving questions about whether this latest initiative will move beyond the statement of intent.
From Khartoum, it's clear the government is drawing a firm line, welcoming any support to end the war, but rejecting what it sees as outside interference that undermines Sudan's sovereignty. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Britain's far right on the march again in their biggest show of strength yet, led by a man who made his name scapegoating migrants and Muslims and spreading conspiracy theories. Simultaneously, a counter-demonstration organized by rights groups and unions against what they call racism and the rise of fascism.
Everyone should have free speech, but there's a defined line between free speech and hate speech, and some of the things he says is hate speech. So we have the freedom of speech to speak up and speak out about what's right and what's wrong.
I think it's a very cheap shot to point your finger at asylum seekers, people who are fleeing war-torn countries, wars that are created by the West. And, you know, I think it's we've got to show people like Tommy Robinson, who I hear is funded by Israel. You know, we have to show him what's what.
At the heart of the far-right's rhetoric, immigration. They blame immigrants, especially non-Europeans, as the reason behind their economic woes. The counter-demonstrators here say the reasons should be sought elsewhere.
It's just a smokescreen. People need to wake up and realize that these people, these refugees who have come to seek solace in our country, are not the problem. They are not the problem. Look closer to home. Your government is your problem.
Well, that goes back to many, many years of austerity measures by the Tory government. I'm not hiding the fact that there's a lot of problems in this country in terms of like the economy. Everything's been crashed, but it's not the refugees and the migrants that are to blame, but actually the politicians and their hypocrisy and their lies and their mismanagement of this country.
For 14 years, conservative governments imposed economic austerity while whipping up anti-migrant hysteria to distract from the damage. Under Labour, the promised change is yet to come.
They're angry with, and I understand some of the reasons they're angry, but I think they're blaming the wrong people. And yes, you have the right to free speech, but I think it should be based in fact. And a lot of their free speech that they claim isn't factual, and it's done to whip up more anger for their own means.
Also tapping into that anger, right-wing Reform UK, led by wealthy politician Nigel Farage, whose party is rising sharply in the polls, with tackling migration top of his agenda if elected in the next general election.
At the heart of the problem, the demonstrators here say inequality, the failure of successive governments to look after the vulnerable, and the political system that fuels division rather than solving problems. Saipur is up, London.
On Monday, September 9, Ethiopia officially inaugurated the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, Africa's largest hydropower project on the Blue Nile. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed hailed the moment as a historic achievement for his country and the wider region. But as Addis Ababa celebrated, the spotlight quickly shifted downstream to Sudan, where questions about water security and the dam's impact on daily life remain unresolved.
The GERD is a strategic project for Ethiopia to meet its electricity needs. Egypt and Sudan fear possible risks, but in my visits, I have seen that for Sudan, the benefits outweigh the harm. It curbs floods, provides electricity, and engineers have assured its safety.
For Sudan, GERD offers both potential benefits and risks. Experts say it could help regulate destructive floods and provide more stable flows for irrigation and power. Yet Khartoum fears sudden releases, shortages during dry seasons, and the broader issue of dam safety. Located directly below the massive structure, Sudan is most exposed to any mismanagement, making daily coordination and transparency essential.
The matter doesn't end with this inauguration. Sudan and Egypt must take a strong stance to protect their rights through all legitimate means. As observers, we should put forward realistic, workable solutions. In my view, the only practical path is genuine joint management of the dam, where every decision is made collectively by all three countries.
Just hours after the inauguration, Egypt addressed the UN Security Council, emphasizing that it will not recognize Ethiopia's unilateral control over Nile waters and reaffirming the importance of international law. Previous trilateral talks among Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt failed to produce a binding agreement, leaving the dispute unresolved. Sudan, for its part, has reiterated its rejection of unilateral measures in the Nile Basin and remains committed to pursuing diplomatic channels to safeguard its national interests.
Standing here by the Nile, Sudan's lifeline, the concerns are clear. Beyond the promises of electricity and flood control, the real question is whether Ethiopia's dam will bring cooperation or deepen the uncertainty downstream. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Of the continuous genocide in Gaza by the Israeli occupation, many took to the streets of New York City to condemn the relentless and open field bombing campaigns that have now left nearly 65,000 killed. Protesters held banners calling for the freedom of Palestine and the end of the forced starvation of its people as they marched the busy streets chanting for an end to the occupation by Israeli forces.
To tell the world that this is a complete hypocrisy, because they want to uphold international laws for other people, but when it comes to Gaza, absolutely no response. And we deserve to be treated like normal human beings, just like every other person, and everybody deserves basic human rights.
Protesters are demanding that the Israeli occupation be sanctioned and an arms embargo be put in place, especially after the IOF has called for the evacuation of Gaza under the guise of so-called safe zones. This comes after the genocide is nearing 2 years, and the people of New York are saying, and they demand, an immediate ceasefire.
Appraisals were heard among the crowd for the global Sumud flotilla, which Israel has already attacked in Tunisia, as a flock of boats made their way to Gaza to break the imposed siege, while some protesters expressed hope in persevering until the siege is broken.
We have reached the point where Israel has turned the world into such a place where those who try to bring food are treated as criminals, while those who try to bring changes are treated as villains, and while those who orchestrate and lead genocides like Benjamin Netanyahu are treated with respect, are welcomed into the halls of international diplomacy.
I am seeing a slight shift, towards the better. It's going to be a tough fight, and we're going to fight harder. We're just going to keep fighting harder just to throw out our message that eventually Palestine will be free, and we need to save Gaza. We need to save Gaza now. No one is free unless Gaza is free.
With the UN General Assembly approaching in a week, people are already preparing to protest war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu's arrival to New York, while the international community continues to stay silent. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
London's Genesis Cinema, a packed hall, watches From Ground Zero, a series of 22 short films by as many directors spanning fiction, documentary, and animation. Made by young filmmakers inside Gaza as the Israeli genocide unfolds, the collection captures fragments of daily life in the territory.
For so many years, I was making Palestinian stories into cinema and showing them all over the world. For sure, when something like this happening, I need to share these stories with the world. I need to show what's going on in the small details of their life, far from the news.
One film shows the effects of Israel's starvation campaign. Another, musicians and vocalists refusing to surrender joy, and another, a husband remembering his last phone call to his wife and children before they were killed by Israel. Together, they show audiences the devastation, the heartache, and the determination of a people who continue to create.
The message I kind of take with me is that the children, no matter how much they're suffering, they are still able to tell stories of hope and to get over this. And I think within the sadness of it all, losing people, losing your home and everything, your identity, your being a Palestinian is what keeps them going.
I felt closer to the people that are actually in Palestine, especially because we actually heard names. So it's not just numbers. And I think it's very important to people know the actual names of the people that are there.
The films have already been shown at international festivals to rapturous applause.
The screening feels like more than cinema. It is a reminder that storytelling is an act of survival, with the directors insisting that their voices be heard. For the Palestinian diaspora, this is a bridge. For others, a chance to witness lives that are often reduced to headlines, demonized and dehumanized.
I think in spite of the darkness, the grief, the sadness that the film shows, you also get a perspective of hope. No matter what's happening, these are people who are attached to a land. These are people who are surviving colonialism. They're enduring a genocide. The easy option is walk out, get your freedom. But it's not freedom. It's removal from what's part of your culture. You might stay alive, but are you living if you're not on the land that it means more to you?
Supported by award-winning American director Michael Moore, From Ground Zero offers no easy answers, but it proves that even in the harshest of circumstances, art endures. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square, one of the biggest and most beautiful squares in the world. a UNESCO World Heritage Site that must be on your bucket list.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square is located in the center of the city of Isfahan. It was built during the 17th century, during the Safavid era. This square, with its rich historical background, is one of the most spectacular attractions of the city of Isfahan.
On the western side of Naqsh-e Jahan Square, you find an exquisite palace, which is known as Ali Qapu. It was built during the Safavid era, and it was considered the political center of the country.
Ali Qapu literally means Great Gate. The palace is actually a six-story building, but you won't realize this until you go to the backyard. It was here that the Safavid king would entertain his special visitors. He also celebrated Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
We've just been to the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. We went up the staircase to the number of levels and just saw the amazing decorative artwork, and then went up to the top chamber where we believe the musicians used to play, the amazing acoustics.
This amazing structure is rich in wall paintings. The doors, walls, and ceilings are highly ornamented with intricately designed floral motifs. On the sixth floor is where royal receptions were held and was referred to as the music hall.
One of the main attractions of Naqsh-e Jahan Square are the mosques that are located in it. Mosques that are not only considered masterpieces of Iranian Islamic architecture, but that are famous for their tile works.
Imam Mosque, also known as Jame Abbasi Mosque, is on the south side of the square. It is considered an excellent example of the Islamic era architecture of Iran. Its splendor is mainly due to the beauty of its seven-color tiles.
Probably the most amazing part of this mosque is its tile works. The tiles are so intricately designed that you can even find postcards and replicas of them around the square.
The magnificent tile work serves a double function. Aside from ornamenting the mosque, there was a need to weatherproof the simple clay bricks used in its construction. The tiles are decorated in seven colors, which is why they are called haftrang, which literally means seven colors.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's so big and colourful. And what else, Dan?
Yeah, the tiles and the decorations are amazing, aren't they? Yeah.
Here you can find one of the most exquisite masterpieces of Iranian architecture, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, which was built by Shah Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty.
What fascinates me most about this mosque is, first of all, architecturally it's a unique work. You don't have anything like that in any part of Iran or elsewhere, because it's a private mosque built for the father-in-law of Shah Abbas the Great. In terms of ornament, what fascinates me most is the interplay of natural tile colors with various sorts of blue color in these in the whole composition. The composition of natural tile color with blue, that's unique and that's very nice.
I can't tell you enough about the beauty of Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, but in my opinion, the most amazing part is the tile work under the dome. And if you're familiar with Persian carpets, you will find this design quite familiar. The Bazaar of Isfahan is one of the oldest and largest bazaars in the Middle East. Some parts of it are more than 1,000 years old. The bazaar is abundant in handicrafts, so if you're looking for a little something to take back, this is where you need to go. Probably one of the most interesting parts of Naqsh-e-Jahan Square is Qaisariya Bazaar, one of the longest bazaars in the world that connects Naqsh-e-Jahan Square to Atiq Square. It's about 8 kilometers long. The square is still as vibrant as it was, today mostly with the presence of tourists rather than merchants, but it is still reminiscent of its days of glory, when public ceremonies were held, Nowruz was celebrated, and polo games were played. Now, after all of these amazing things, there's only one thing I can say. Visiting Naqsh-e-Jahan Square must be on your bucket list. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi for Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.